Hey friends, it's Dan. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Hope you're enjoying the holiday season. Apologies for the rough condition of my voice. I'm fighting a bit of a cold. I should probably have these pipes insured by Lloyd's of London since they are my meal ticket, but I don't. It's time for the year-end episode of The Sporkful, which by tradition is an episode where I pick an episode out of my personal private stash from the previous year to share with you again. Now, I usually try to pick one that's one that maybe you would have overlooked. So I'm not going to play the one with Weird Al Yankovic or Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, because those ones are kind of already going to grab your attention. I try to pick one out that I happen to really love, but that you might have said, I'm going to skip this one. So this year, I'm going to play you my episode on eating throughout history, which was taped at the American Museum of Natural History. And separately, it includes a little intro piece with Deepak Chopra about eating alone and focusing on what you're eating. So I really enjoyed this episode. And I will say briefly, while we're in the spirit of giving here, end of the year, whatnot, just a friendly reminder that, hey, The Sporkful accepts donations. In fact, we need donations to keep going and growing. It does cost money to produce The Sporkful. Takes a lot of time and effort, and you can sign up to give a few bucks a month and get secret episodes or T-shirts. A one-time donation of any amount. If you give a one-time donation of $50, you get a free Sporkful T-shirt to wear proudly throughout your neighborhood. So to do that, go to sporkful.com and click on donate. Now here's the year-end episode of The Sporkful.
This is The Sporkful.
So, friends, lately I've been doing regular segments on Weekend Edition Sunday with my old friend Rachel Martin, who I had the privilege of working with back when I was at NPR, and covering food and eating from a variety of different angles. Hope you've had a chance to hear some of those segments. If you haven't, that's a great reason to be following The Sporkful on Twitter, on Facebook, or tuning in regularly to the blog at sporkful.com. Now, just this past week, I did a segment with Rachel about eating alone in honor of Valentine's Day. And as part of that segment, I spoke with Deepak Chopra. I was inspired to call him up because I was thinking about eating alone and just about how eating alone offers great opportunities, but there's also some pitfalls. I mean, on one hand, it gives you a great opportunity to really focus on what you're eating. You know, you don't have to make conversation with anyone. You don't have to pretend to be a functional member of society. Focus on your food. Flip side, though, is oftentimes I think when we eat alone, we all can be distracted or be doing other things, and you end up barely knowing what you just ate. So I called up Deepak Chopra to get advice on mindfulness and awareness and how to get the most out of solo dining. And here's what he told me.
I think eating in solitude is a great experience. I'd like to kind of make a distinction between solitude and being alone. Alone signifies loneliness, whereas solitude means really connecting with yourself, including your body. And to eat in solitude is a very sensuous and wonderful experience. You know, when I eat anything, I for a minute experience gratitude for the abundance of the universe which supplies it. I also wonder where it came from.
I want you to imagine that right now you're talking to someone who is sitting down for a meal in solitude. The plate of food has just been placed in front of them. It looks and smells delicious. And I want you to just speak directly to that person. What would you say to that person to help them get the most out of this meal?
Sit down quietly, take a few deep breaths, and then enjoy the food with full awareness and in silence. Don't break the spell. Feel your body. Feel the sensations that are aroused without forcing anything. And monitor your level of hunger. And don't treat your body as a garbage can.
So that was Deepak's advice, and I have to tell you, right after talking to him, I went out and got some pizza and experienced something I am now calling total pizza awareness. And I hope you will take Deepak's advice to heart and experience it as well. Just not only tasting the food, but just to look at it, to smell it, to feel the textures, just to be aware of every physical sensation involved in eating. And this is especially an important thing to think about while you're eating alone. And it just takes the enjoyment to another level. Total pizza awareness. Try it.
The
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and we're about to challenge your assumptions about consumption and drop a sporkful of knowledge on you. Because we're obsessively compulsive about eating more awesomely. And because if history has taught us anything, it's that the hosts of food shows need a lot of catchphrases. Let's go ahead and jump right into today's topic for mastication and rumination, which is eating throughout history. The American Museum of Natural History here in New York City is currently doing an exhibit called Our Global Kitchen, Food, Nature, Culture. It is a really fun, very interesting exhibit that traces the role of food really throughout history and throughout so many different cultures. And there are multimedia components. There's an area where you can sort of stand over a screen and have a POV look at as if you are cooking one of four different meals from all over the world. There are areas where you can smell different scents from around the world, and there's a real working kitchen. And I was lucky enough to interview the two curators at the exhibit. We walked through. We had a lot of fun, but also got a lot of very interesting and useful information about eating throughout history that I want to share with you now. So let's go to the tape. Here I am at the Museum of Natural History. So here with me first is Dr. Eleanor Sterling, co-curator of Our Global Kitchen, Food, Nature, Culture, and the director of the Museum Center for Biodiversity and Conservation. Hi, Dr. Sterling.
Hello.
May I call you Eleanor?
Sure thing.
All right, thanks. And then we also have here Dr. Mark Norell. He is co-curator of Our Global Kitchen, Food, Nature, Culture, and chair of the Museum's Division of Paleontology. Hi, Dr. Norell.
Hi.
And can I call you Mark?
Of course.
As chair of the museum's division of paleontology, does that mean you oversee the dinosaur bones?
Yes.
I would think that whenever you walk into a new group of people and you tell them that that's what you do, it's probably hard for you to escape the room after a certain period of time. Is that fair to say?
It's a burden.
It depends on the room.
Have you heard about the paleo diet, and what do you think of it as a paleontologist?
I've heard of it, but, you know, I tend to just eat what I think is good for me.
Because I have a friend who was on that diet, and then he threw a football and his arm broke in half.
I don't think you can relate one instance to anything.
It may have been a pre-existing condition. But in general, what do you think of the idea of eating the way people did in that era?
To me, eating is all about like what tastes good. I try to eat very healthily, but also I want to eat what tastes good. So I'm not going to sit there and eat a bunch of green stuff and like hardly cooked tough meat on a table just because somebody did it 10,000 years ago.
Right. There is such thing as progress, I suppose.
Exactly.
Should we walk a little bit?
Sure.
All right. So, Mark, what's your favorite part of the exhibit here?
I don't know. My favorite part is probably the end because I really am sort of, I enjoy the aspect of the way that, you know, culture and food come together. I mean, I'm here because I like to eat, okay? Eleanor wants to save the world. I like to eat. So so that's sort of this unholy thing that we're in. So,
and Eleanor, I should tell my listeners, you are a vegetarian.
Oh, that is one of my features, yeah.
I'm sure there's other things about you we'll find out over the course of this interview.
I would hope so.
Let's go into the kitchen. One of the great things about this exhibit is that there's an actual working kitchen here, which I think is very exciting. Oh my goodness, what are they making here? This looks like chocolate.
I hope it looks like chocolate. It is chocolate.
Yeah, have one.
I will. So Mark, you guys have both been around the world for your work and I'm sure eaten in some pretty exotic and in some situations difficult circumstances in the middle of the Gobi Desert or in the middle of Latin America or Africa. I mean, are there sort of some universal rules of the road that you can share for eating in adverse circumstances?
Yeah, eat what the locals eat and you're less likely to get sick.
Eleanor?
Yeah, I try to eat things that are peeled and cooked.
What's the food like in the Gobi Desert, Mark?
We eat incredibly well because we're hundreds of miles away from the nearest town, so we provision really well, and that a number of the people on the expeditions are good cooks, and we make homemade gnocchis, we make pizzas.
Is that traditional Mongolian fare?
Not at all. Traditional Mongolian fare is you find the oldest, greasiest sheep you can find, boil it, and then take and skim all the fat off the top and spread that across a piece of stale bread. And
that actually sounds pretty good. What do you do with the rest of the sheep?
You eat it over days and days, and days until it gets too maggoty to be able to actually choke it down.
Okay. Well, so is there a point at which it has maggots, but it's not yet too maggoty?
Oh, yeah. Because then you, dry the maggots out. You put them in a pot, and then and then heat it up really slowly, and they all crawl out. And then you put water in it, floats them off.
That is very useful information.
It's a traditional technique from the old days.
So I should describe here. So we're in an actual working kitchen that's part of the exhibit here at the Museum of Natural History. And every couple of weeks, you guys are doing a different theme, different types of foods that you're going to be cooking. I was here a few weeks ago, and there was cornbread. Now it looks like we have chocolate truffles. Is that right?
It's chocolate in general. Today just happens to be truffles, but they get inventive here.
Yeah, and if folks come here, you'll get some free food in addition to a very great exhibit.
Well, we had to do that. I mean, you come to an exhibition, you're learning about food, you're reading about food, you're talking about food, you get hungry.
So, Mark, you discovered an oviraptor, I should say a fossil,
of an oviraptor
nesting on a brood of eggs.
Right.
Are you able, in your research, to have any idea what dinosaur eggs might have tasted like?
Yeah, well, we eat them all the time. We just call them birds now. So that, the eggs of these animals, like oviraptor, in microstructure and everything else, have exactly the shells are identical to the eggs of modern birds. So an egg of Tyrannosaurus would have tasted just like a chicken egg, just bigger.
So let's go over here and check out this part of the exhibit. This is a meal that we might have seen between, it says 58 BC to 29 AD. So, Eleanor, I want you to tell me a little bit about this. We should add that there is actually ambient sound being piped in to set the scene of the period of time that we are in. So if you hear that sound, friends, that will help to transport you. You hear that laughter? That's people laughing right around the time of the birth of Jesus. Eleanor, tell me about what we see before us, please.
So this is a meal that the first Empress of Rome, Livia Drusilla, might have eaten. And what we tried to do was to figure out what was on the table regularly so that people could sit on one side of the table and feel like they were eating a meal with famous people around the world. So we have some things from the Mediterranean that people might feel are pretty obvious, like olives. And there's something that looks a little bit like a pesto sauce, some kind of a green leaf sauce. And we have some eggs that are stuffed. And then we also have sea urchins, which might be a surprise for people to think about that as a delicacy on a plate in Rome.
Let me ask you guys a question that applies to this particular part of the exhibit and the exhibit in general, which is, in putting this exhibit together, were there any tips, techniques for cooking or eating, recipes, dishes, ingredients that you happened upon or were reminded of that have changed the way you eat or brought something back to your palate that you were like, oh, I forgot that I liked that thing, or I'm going to try eating it the way they ate it 2,000 years ago?
No. I'm a creature of habit. Like, I'm open to new things. And
he had the same meal every day for the entire several years that we worked on this project. Every day for lunch.
What was it?
Sushi.
And is there anything from any other part of the exhibit, Eleanor, that you've done that's... you're pointing over here. I want to see if there's something else that's had an impact on your eating habits. Oh, we're now moving over to the time of Kublai Khan, 1215 to 1294, a movable feast. And I should mention just quickly that if people hear the sound of liquids being poured or dishes being cleared, we are now in Kublai Khan's living room, essentially, and those are the sounds of the meal being served, so people shouldn't be confused by that. And what were you going to say, Eleanor?
Well, just that this, when Mark and I were trying to think about what we thought were really fundamental happenings in the food world, we realized that fusion was key. And a lot of people think about Cuban, Dominican, Chinese food as being this amazing new thing in the world that we have these fusion across cultures. But as Mark will tell you, this particular exhibit we're in front of was a place where fusion was happening all across this empire.
Everything that we eat is fusion cuisine. I mean, whether it's you're ripping it off from your neighbor or it's across the planet, so...
I think that makes you think about food in a different way, and it makes me eat differently by appreciating the depth of experience that the food has had before it showed up on my plate.
Okay, so we're going to wander over here to Jane Austen, summer 1810. We're now in Kent in southeast England, and this exhibit talks about ice cream before electricity. How did they do that, Mark?
it just requires ice. And if you think about the whole problem of ice, you know, like you're in Southeast England, it's the middle of summer. I mean, it's like the weather's miserable there all the time and stuff, but it's really miserable in the summer. And so where are they going to get ice from? Well, they might be able to get it from Scotland, or they might be able to get it during the wintertime. They have to keep it in sheds or barns, and they have to keep it covered with hay or something else so that it'll last through the summertime, and that they're able to make these like great desserts like ice cream. So that it was a real sort of ultra gourmet, ultra high class, very exclusive, very expensive dessert before the advent of electrical coolers.
But how could they even keep ice for any period of time, even in a barn or some kind of storage facility?
You'd be surprised, even underground, how long ice lasts. I mean, if you like make, you know, carve a block of ice that's 3 feet long by like 2 feet by 2 feet, it'll last just by virtue of its size in a well insulated area for months.
I don't suppose you made any ice cream in the Gobi Desert?
Never ice cream.
I made ice cream on an uninhabited island in Madagascar in the middle of the summer.
Oh, my God. Please tell me that story.
Yeah. So we had fishing boats that were nearby, and they wanted to come on shore to be able to get some fresh water from our waterfall. And so we said, sure, fine, no problem, come on. And then they felt so sad that we were there in the middle of this heat, this uninhabited island in the heat. I was living there for a couple years, that they brought this block of ice on land, and I was so excited to have cool water. I was so thrilled, but it was this huge block of ice. So I had, you know, a glass of ice water, and I had another glass of ice water, and then I was like, now what do I do with the ice?
Gin and tonic.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we didn't have any of that. But we did have eggs, and we had sweetened condensed milk, and we had a fire, and we had some vanilla because it was Madagascar. And so we made this cream sauce, and then we put it inside a Nalgene water bottle, and then we found this big can from an oil can, an old oil can, and we filled that full of ice and rock salt, and we rolled it up and down the beach. We made ice cream.
And how did it come out?
It was more of a smoothie than an ice cream, but it was delicious.
Yeah, I mean, I guess beggars can't be choosers, right?
Hey, it was the best ice cream I had all that year.
Were you with locals there?
Yeah.
Had they had ice cream like this before?
Oh, no. No.
So what was their reaction to it?
Well, first they thought we were crazy. They're like, why are you using the eggs in that way? And the eggs are really important. And why can't we just have these for breakfast or for over rice for dinner? But after we convinced them that it was a really good use of all of those resources, they were pretty excited. It was, you know, it was hot. So they loved the flavor and the texture.
God, I wish I could have been there to see. I mean, to see an adult have their first, I mean, it was fun for me to watch my daughter eat ice cream for the first time at age one or whatever, but to see an adult who has a lifetime's worth of experiences eat ice cream for the first time, I mean, it must have been exciting to share that experience with them.
Well, we spent a lot of time talking about why it was happening, because of course I cooked something, made it hot, and then I didn't actually make that thing cold directly. I just surrounded it with ice and then rolled it back and forth. And so that transformation was something we spent a little bit of time in Malagasy trying to explain.
But in the end, it sounds like it turned out well.
Yep, absolutely. It was well worth the effort.
So I can turn back to Jane Austen's ice cream here. The ice cream is actually shaped like a column. I'm not going to try to guess whether it's Doric, Ionic, or...
Can't see the top, so you don't know.
Right, okay, thank you, Mark, for not making me sound stupid. Did they actually serve ice cream in shapes like this back then?
Yeah, it was very popular all through, like, Napoleonic times, as well as up into Victorian times, to serve things in these really elaborate molds like this.
Because vertical food was a big trend in fancy restaurants for a while, but I guess even that concept wasn't so new after all, huh?
Exactly.
So the one thing that's cool, though, about ice cream, one of the reasons why we have this whole exhibition is because I love ice cream. And if you have...
Basically, this whole Natural History Museum exhibit is an elaborate ploy for Eleanor to be able to talk about ice cream. Is that right?
That's correct. And but no, what was fun is thinking about, you know, we feature this summer ice house in England, but then Mark can tell you about the fact that these ice houses were actually found in China in the 1300s. I mean, these ice houses were spread throughout the world, in fact, and people were trying to solve that same kind of problem over and over in different places.
Well, even before that, their use during the Tang Dynasty in 700 AD, that there was melons that were taken from the oasis towns in Central Asia, because the Dian Shan and Pamir Mountains and stuff, Kunlun Mountains are so close and they have glaciers. And they would pack these melons in ice and put them on the backs of camels and then take them to like Beijing and to Samarkand on the Silk Road in things that look just exactly like modern coolers, you know, that they were instead of lined with aluminum or plastic, they're lined with lead, but they had insulation in them with camel hair and everything else and stuff. There's like loaded in the back of camels and taken across the desert.
It almost makes you wonder, I mean, what's left to be invented? I guess it helps that we keep forgetting that we've invented these things and that we can keep being impressed with ourselves.
Well, I don't think we were inventing anything. I mean, we're just improving and tinkering with. Even things like, I mean, freeze-drying, okay? Like, freeze-drying was a big thing back in the 70s. Well, we got to freeze-dry all these foods and everything because it makes them last. Well, in Tibet, where I work sometimes, people take yak meat and they'll cut it in really thin slices and then they'll lay it out on rocks in the middle of the night. And just overnight, the ice crystals will just form on it. In the morning, they just dust them off, and they're completely dry. So it's like one night non-solar drying, just by virtue of it gets so cold, it just draws the water out. So,
and then how long does it last?
I mean, they can just keep it all winter in their houses then and things, and it's just dry. So it's like jerky.
It really drives home the universality of food and culture, and some of the video presentations that you guys have I found really powerful.
Yeah, and we do that throughout. In the growing section, for instance, not only do you see how people create food and eat the food, but it's really how do they find something in nature and figure out that it's edible. I mean, there's some things we eat in the world that are really curious. They have poisons, they're funny looking, they don't look edible to me. And yet someone in our deep past figured out that they were edible, figured out how to process those foods, and really it took the ingenuity to identify those as food sources and then created them. That's pretty neat to think about.
One of the ones I've always wondered about is popcorn. Who was the first guy or woman who dried out some popcorn and accidentally or possibly purposely dropped it into a pot and cooked it? I mean,
well, actually, I mean, the first corn that was ever domesticated was popcorn, or thought to be popcorn by a lot of anthropologists and archaeologists. So, like, you know, it could have been totally serendipitous. I mean, somebody just could have said, what is this weird plant? Throw it in the fire. And all of a sudden it goes boom, 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 boom. And then all the whatever they had laying around the campfire started eating it, and they said, well, we can eat this. And it could have been as easy as that. So,
and I would think that there's probably been a lot of trial and error over time, and there's probably some people who said, hey, let's try eating this, and didn't end up as fortunate as people who ate popcorn. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. Cassava is one of the main roots that a lot of people around the world eat, and it is full of cyanide. So the first person who tried to eat that without preparing it probably didn't fare well.
But and I'm so interested about, I wish I could talk to the first person who said, well, what if we cook it? What if we do this? Maybe then we won't die. I mean, that's a pretty risky field to be in.
It is, but, you know, I think, as Mark said, a lot of it is trial and error. A lot of it's just an accident. You know, something happened, a cassava fell into the fire, somebody stepped on it, it got processed in some way, and suddenly it was edible. I mean, who knows? But we did have millions of years to work on this.
Let's move over here, and I would love if you guys could describe this part of the exhibit to people who obviously can't see it, but I think this is a really cool thing here, this market.
This is a market in the Americas, an Aztec market in Mexico from 1519, so just before the Europeans came, before the Spaniards came. And you have a sense for the kinds of foods that are found here. So you get a sense for what was domesticated in the Americas: tomatoes, corn, squash. Some of them have made their way around the world. Imagine some of those cuisines without the tomato, but really a tomato only showed up a couple hundred years ago in the Italian cuisine. So we try to play with that a little bit. What did foods look like here in Mexico before the chicken was here, before wheat came over, before really there was any cheese in the Americas?
Wait, Mexican food existed before cheese?
You betcha.
And Italian food existed before tomatoes?
Yep.
Mark, what is your technique for eating corn on the cob?
I'm more the typewriter style.
Typewriter style, interesting. I actually like to hold up the corn vertically on the plate and take a knife and chop off the corn niblets, because I feel like when I do it typewriter style, it gets stuck in my teeth.
Yeah.
Did the Aztecs have a solution to that problem?
I did my graduate degree at Yale, and I worked in the basement of one of the buildings where the anthropologists had their collections from Machu Picchu. And so we were surrounded by skulls all the time that we were doing our research. And you would look up and you'd see these amazing skulls that had these abscesses that were clearly from having had corn stuck in their teeth, and then the you know, something rotted, and then the sugars came out, and it created these awful, horrible infections in their bone.
If only they listened to my podcast.
Exactly.
All right, friends. Well, that is it for another great year of The Sporkful. Happy New Year to you and yours. Thank you so much for another great year of The Sporkful, for listening, for participating, for emailing, for interacting, for telling your friends. You guys are what makes The Sporkful fun. You are what makes it great. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And one more quick reminder, if you can, greatly appreciated, drop a few bucks in the tip jar. Any amount is appreciated. You can do that at sporkful.com. Just click on donate. I'll be back in 2 weeks with an all-new episode. Until then, I'm Dan Pashman, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.